This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Brian Larson. A handful of states have proposed or are working on legislation to prevent people experiencing a crisis from having access to guns, something that could help worried families keep their loved ones safe.
A year and a half ago, he started expressing this idea that he would like to get a gun and kill himself with it.
Colorado lawmakers are expected to work on their own version of a so-called red flag law this session. But do these laws really work? We'll get a closer look. Then, if you think Colorado roadways are congested, you should look at what's going on in Earth's orbit.
Coming up, we'll meet a Boulder businessman who's working on preventing traffic jams in space.
Hashtag future problems.
Back in Colorado's early days, the Opera House was the heart of many small towns. Now, those still standing are more of a nod to our state's history.
I can just feel this energy around all of what's happened in the past and everybody that's performed here, and there's an essence about this place that not many have.
We'll hear how revitalizing the Opera House could raise the community's arts profile today.
And our film critic Howie Moshevitz reviews a new movie about two of cinema's most legendary and beloved comics, Laurel and Hardy.
But first, the transgender community is reacting to this week's Supreme Court ruling that revives a ban on their military service. KUNC's Michael DeJuana had the chance to speak with a Fort Carson soldier who just returned from Afghanistan.
When the Army needed a physical therapist in Afghanistan, Army Captain Olivia Stelic says she volunteered. And for the past 9 months, she took care of her fellow service members, returning to Fort Carson in Colorado Springs about a week ago.
It's disappointing and almost bizarre that I was there doing my job, you know, for so many months, and nobody had any issues with that, right? None of my patients, none of my peers, none of my commanders, nobody in any neighboring units. Everybody was pleased with what I brought to the table and just happy that I was there doing my job.
Stelic falls into an exception to the ban for service members already serving openly. She says transgender service members aren't going to go away. Michael DeJuana, KUNC.
You know, we hear a lot about cutting government services, but There's a new office of state government, and it's got a rather unusual name. The Office of Saving People Money on Healthcare.
Well, there's no question about what it does.
Right. Governor Jared Polis launched the venture this week when he signed an executive order surrounded by cancer survivors and residents who've struggled to afford insurance premiums.
We're looking forward to working with the legislature to research the best methods for how to increase competition and drive down costs, including exploring a public option.
Now, the new office will cost just under $250,000 to start and will be led by Lieutenant Governor Diane Primavera, who is a cancer survivor herself.
After the Parkland school shooting in Florida last year, 8 states passed some version of an extreme risk protection order law. These measures, also known as red flag laws, are used to prevent people in crisis from accessing guns. As Colorado lawmakers work on one of these bills, KUNC's Lee Patterson has more on how effective they are in reducing gun violence.
Judy Amabile and her 3 kids all live in a bright, beautiful home in downtown Boulder. There's a sleeping bag on the front porch.
So my son isn't supposed to come in the house when he's been drinking, and that's why we have this sleeping bag out here. And anybody else would look at that and just say, what? But for us, it's like, oh,
that's life.
That's life.
Life with Amabile's 26-year-old son is tough, and it's not just an alcohol issue. She says he's been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, personality disorders. She asked us not to use his name in this story out of concern for his well-being.
A year and a half ago, he started expressing this idea that he would like to get a gun and kill himself with it.
Around this time, Amabile noticed a charge on his debit card from a local gun shop, so she called them up.
And they said that's the cost of a background check.
She and her ex-husband went over there.
We were shown the firearm that he had chosen, and we wept with fear about how close he was to killing himself. And we asked the guy, please, please don't sell him this gun.
He agreed. And though that immediate crisis was averted, Amabile still feels that she can't really stop her son from buying a gun. He could be stopped, for example, if a judge committed him to a mental health hospital, but the bar for these things is really high. Her son has been hospitalized multiple times and has attempted suicide by other methods. Amabile says that's why an Extreme Risk Protection Order bill, or ERPO, in Colorado would be so meaningful for her.
Because if he succeeded in getting a gun and he attempted suicide with a gun, the chances that he would be successful are so much higher.
Extreme risk laws are different in every state, but basically, a family member or law enforcement officer can petition a judge for an order that allows firearms to be taken away from someone in crisis and prohibits them from buying a new one. Soon after, the person in question has a hearing and can ask for their guns back.
We want to make sure that when he goes in to get a background check, it comes back no. And that's just an enormous peace of mind.
A recent study found that extreme risk protection order type laws in Indiana and Connecticut may have prevented hundreds of firearm suicides, though suicides by other methods did increase. Connecticut has had a gun seizure law since 1999. In the first 10 years the law was in place, in over half of all cases, the alleged risk was suicide.
Detective DeMonte.
Detective Anthony DeMonte is with the Wethersfield Police Department in Connecticut near Hartford. He deals with these situations.
What would it look like? Two officers go to a house. Let's say there's an elderly male there. They walk in and he's bleeding from both wrists.
If DeMonte finds he has guns, he'd try to get a warrant and remove them. He says this is a tool that can reduce gun violence.
The example that I gave there, they could hurt themselves, they could hurt someone else. And if we have the opportunity to take that out of the equation, at least we can do that.
But that whole removal process is a problem for some. An ERPO bill died in the Colorado legislature last year, in part because of due process concerns. One state senator said that the bill could be a good thing, but that taking guns away from people with no proof, quote, that's a very slippery slope. Judy Amabile disagrees.
Why does your right to have a firearm trump somebody else's right to be protected from themselves in a moment of crisis?
In Colorado, a state with a high suicide rate and a strong history of gun ownership, that will be up for debate this legislative session. For Guns in America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Guns in America is a new public media reporting project on the role of guns in America, and you can find more stories on our website, kunc.org.
Now, former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly were in Denver this week to help launch Colorado Gun Owners for Safety. The group gives a boost to some gun owners who want state lawmakers to pass stronger gun laws.
The group of two dozen hunters and gun collectors say it represents the, quote, moderate middle on the issue of gun control. They want a so-called red flag bill, but Kelly says there are hurdles to overcome.
You know, in a lot of cases, the people we elect to office hesitate to act on this issue. And that's because, you know, there is a corporate gun lobby that has worked really, really hard for a long time to try to prevent new legislation from being passed.
Now, Giffords and Kelly say red flag bills have saved lives in other states. They lead a national organization that has pushed for stronger gun laws around the country. They started the group after Giffords survived a shooting in her Arizona district back in 2011. Governor Jared Polis has selected the first woman to serve as Colorado's Commissioner of Agriculture. Kate Greenberg has spent the last 10 years working with farmers and helping to shape agricultural policy while working for the National Young Farmers Coalition. KUNC's Esther Honig spoke with Greenberg about her career and the challenges of the position.
Tell us about your personal background. How did you come to agriculture originally? What drew you there?
So I came to agriculture later in life. I originally from Minnesota, grew up most of my life in the city in Minneapolis, but my early years was out in farm country in Mankato, southern Minnesota. That's where I fell in love with the land. And it wasn't until I left Minnesota that I fell in love with agriculture as sort of the next phase in that. So, I left, went to Eastern Washington State, realized I had been the beneficiary of farmers and ranchers, sort of the beneficiary of their work for my whole life, and without understanding really what it took to get food on the table. And I think once I realized that sort of gratitude and sense of service I developed toward agriculture and farmers and ranchers really came alive. So I started farming, directly in college, out of college, and as I was working on the land, I started to see my role as an advocate, as someone who can start building bridges across sectors, across communities, who, I believe firmly in listening, as I mentioned, and asking people what their experience is, what they're up against, rather than making assumptions.
How do you think you'll be received as the first female to hold this position and represent an industry that's largely dominated by men?
Well, I'm excited about it. I think there have always been women in agriculture, and oftentimes women are not counted in the same way as men in terms of how we're counted on the census, the roles that we've played traditionally. But more and more women are getting into ag. More and more women are running their own businesses, are taking on leadership on farms and ranches, and are taking on leadership in other aspects of ag as well, not just on the farm, but in elected office, and hopefully fighting for agriculture in positions of advocacy, in research and extension. I think that there is just so much opportunity for women in agriculture, and I am excited about what's possible. I hope everybody's excited about what's possible. And, I want to see more and more young women consider careers and lives in agriculture as well.
You've worked with young people as a leader with the National Young Farmers Coalition, as you mentioned. And can you talk a little bit about how we could lower barriers that right now make farming for young people pretty difficult?
Gosh, I mean, this is sort of the nexus of a lot of these, challenges. For a lot of young people, I mean, whether you're coming at it from a multi-generational operation or you're starting fresh, there are tons of challenges. I mean, there's enough challenges with just, with the weather and the hailstorm that can wipe out your entire crop and water, right? But then you get the challenges of access and affordability, especially around land. The rising cost of land is prohibiting lots of young people from either entering the business or scaling up their businesses. Same is true with access to credit and capital. Financing a farm business is tough, especially when you're, again, starting out on your own. So in my mind, we've got a ton of things, of issues to face, but kind of just the way I see the world is that they are also opportunities, and agriculture has risen to those opportunities at every obstacle in the past, and I am excited to see how we do so again.
Kate Greenberg, new Commissioner of Agriculture here in Colorado, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Esther Honig, KUNC.
We have a lot more great stuff to get to, so stick around. Brian, I'm even going to suggest that the rest of this episode is the space opera.
Okay. How do you figure?
Well, we're going to visit a historic opera house that was once the place to be, at least until legalized gambling took over. And we'll meet an entrepreneur who's working on the problem of traffic congestion in space. So there you go. Space opera.
Okay. So this episode is going where no podcast has gone before.
How did I know?
I couldn't resist.
You'd be there with a Star Trek reference. I knew it.
Of course.
All right. But briefly, before we get to that story, we learned this week that Denver's Velorama Festival will not return this year. The musical accompaniment of the Colorado Classic is being scrapped as organizers refocus on the cycling aspect of the race, which is now a women's only event. The news comes on the heels of Denver losing another large-scale music festival, Grand Doozy, which announced it was going on hiatus after its debut last summer.
The Central City Opera House opened its doors for the first time back in 1878. Mm. It was a labor of love for the town's Welsh and Cornish miners, and it quickly became the hub of the community. Now, Colorado's oldest existing opera house could once again become the heart of Central City. KUNC's arts reporter Stacy Nick has more.
It's a crisp but not uncomfortable 50 degrees on the day Eric Chin and Lisa Zito with the Central City Opera Association take me on a tour of the closed-for-the-season opera house. Outside, anyway.
Oh, it is cold. You can feel it like the second you walk over the threshold. It's
because a creek runs through it.
According to Chin, the opera's director of historic properties, a wooden flume was placed over Eureka Creek, and the building was constructed on top.
In the early years, there was an opening in the flume that would allow for natural air conditioning that would also allow for a humidity level to exist in the opera house, which was considered good for the singers' voices.
But more than 140 years later, the opera house still doesn't have a working heating system. And because of that, it's only usable for about 8 weeks a year during the summer.
One of the ultimate goals is to even heat the opera house so that we can work with other arts organizations throughout the year for performances.
The Central City Opera House was the place during its first 4 years. Theater, musical acts, even Buffalo Bill and P.T. Barnum performed there. But soon, the Tabor Grand Opera House opened in Denver, along with the Tabor Opera House in Leadville. To stay afloat, the venue had to adjust. For a brief time in the 1920s, it even hosted kangaroo boxing.
And that's like a cartoon, you know, where the boxer is fighting the kangaroo, but it actually happened here.
And after that, it stayed as an opera house. But then, in the 1990s, another competitor came along. That's when gambling was legalized in Central City and neighboring Black Hawk. But while Black Hawk thrived,
every single commercial building in Central City was a casino.
That's newly elected mayor Jeremy Fay.
It pushed all other businesses out.
5 years ago, Fay was looking for a location to create a combined hospitality and arts residency space. His brother Tyler, who runs their late father Barry Fay's concert production company Fayline, invited him to a show he was promoting in an empty casino.
I came up to look and saw the vacancy rates up here and was shocked by them. You know, we're 45 minutes away from the core of Denver, but yet 75% of Central City was vacant.
Technically, Fay says the numbers are closer to 55%, but that only accounts for the main floors of buildings. When you take second and third stories into consideration, the numbers rise considerably, which is why Fay thinks now is the perfect time for the arts to make a comeback.
The arts have always been a mainstay in Central City.
One day, Fay envisions an arts academy, residencies for artists, and even a little competition for the Opera House, which at only 550 seats can be tough to make profitable.
We're looking at bringing a couple more venues into the landscape, one of 1,600 seats and one of 3,600 seats.
And with that, there also needs to be more hotels, a grocery store, and freestanding restaurants, he says. Currently, there's only one restaurant in town that's not part of a casino.
My name is Kara Tanucci, the owner of JKQ Barbecue with my husband, Joseph.
Formerly from Las Vegas, the couple have been in the restaurant and casino business for the past 10 years.
So all the raw meat goes on. Usually that's 1:30 in the afternoon, and then we start our whole smoking process. And
they'd love the chance to expand the business. And having more things to do in town during the off-season would help.
There needs to be more places to go, an ice cream shop, you know, a candy store. Those things that the city had lost, they need to come back to offer more to the consumer.
That's why Central City Opera spokeswoman Lisa Zita says town officials and the Opera Association are working together. This season they've already rebooted a jazz festival and introduced a new plein air painting event.
It's almost surreal.
Standing on the Opera House's empty stage, watching our breath, Zita says she can also see the potential.
I can just feel this energy around all of what's happened in the past and everybody that's performed here. And I don't know, there's just I don't even know how to explain it. There's an essence about this place that not many have.
Now it's time for the Opera House and Central City's next act. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
Now let's keep looking to the future, specifically the future in space.
In Colorado, the aerospace industry is thriving. It employs 30,000 workers, each of them solving space-related problems that may sound like something out of a sci-fi movie. One problem that might sound unfortunately familiar to those of us here on Earth, traffic. KUNC's Matt Bloom introduces us to an entrepreneur who's making extraterrestrial travel less of a headache.
Being a space entrepreneur isn't always as glamorous as it sounds. Just ask Bradley Cheatham.
Honestly, entrepreneurship is a really hard job. Space is a really hard job. Doing them together does not make either easier, right?
Cheatham runs a company called Advanced Space. He started it in 2011 as a CU Boulder student with a few friends.
It started with, like, you know, just a couple of us in a loft, right? We didn't have an office. We didn't have any contracts. And so we kind of worked it from nothing up to where we are.
Was the loft in Boulder?
Yeah, it was like the loft in my apartment. It was the extra room in our apartment.
Today, he's pitching one of the company's most promising ideas at a conference at the Colorado School of Mines.
Great, thank you, and thank you all.
On stage, he faces a crowd of industry bigwigs from NASA and space programs around the world.
We've been developing the Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System, or CAPS.
If you missed that, it's Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System. Think the GPS on your phone or car, but for spacecraft to talk to each other. A much-needed thing for future extraterrestrial traffic jams, he says.
Today we have an environment where all operations at the moon in all of deep space are all reliant and all utilize ground tracking assets on the Earth to figure out where they are and where they're going. As you all also probably know, these systems are tightly scheduled and in high demand.
Cheatham wants spacecraft in orbit to be able to communicate without the help of Earth-based systems. And the demand for that kind of technology is high right now because it's about to get a lot busier in space.
We are going to the moon.
That's former congressman and current NASA administrator Jim Bridenstine at a speech at the agency's headquarters earlier this spring. President Donald Trump nominated him to the post last fall, and since then he's made partnering with private industry a top priority.
This will help us conduct more missions, more exploration, more prospecting, and more science to learn more about our nearest neighbor.
Jay Lindell is a former Air Force pilot. He now works with the state's Office of Economic Development and Trade as its aerospace industry champion. He says all these upcoming missions are a potential gold mine, not just for Advanced Space, but for Colorado's entire aerospace industry.
We grew at 4.7% last year. And when you get economic growth above 3%, you're doing really well.
Right now, his office is awarding millions of dollars in grants to small businesses in Colorado, like Advanced Space. The company received $250,000 from his office this year as a part of its Advanced Industries program. Lindell says it's an investment in the future.
And you can see the passion when you're in there talking with them in their business environment. You can see the passion. And the other thing I really like is they're having fun. And it's great to see that here in Colorado.
Most of our stuff is in software and is in code.
At his lab, Bradley Cheatham is showing me how his new navigation system, CAPS, works. On a table, he places three black boxes, each about the size of a portable hard drive. They're hooked up to computer monitors displaying lines and lines of code. Each of the boxes represents spacecraft around the moon.
And so here we can simulate not just what one spacecraft running the software would look like, but what happens if you had three?
His goal is to get these boxes tested in space sometime in the next year. That way, he says, Advanced Space can, one, prove the technology works, and two, sell it to more lunar missions coming up in the near future.
Because we're new, right? So they're not going to wait for us. We have to be ready to fly when those missions need it.
The company has come a long way since it started in Cheatham's loft 7 years ago. And with the help of the state and his scrappy staff in Boulder, he's sure he will be ready to fly. For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom.
So, Aaron, are you a fan of slapstick comedy?
I am, to a degree. I can only take so much.
Okay. Well, I am, and I certainly like all the great comic duos of the past. The new movie, Stan and Ollie, looks back at the fading careers of two aging movie clowns, Laurel and Hardy. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the film is a touching remembrance of a time gone by.
John S. Baird's Stan and Ollie is about what may be the greatest team of comics in the silent period, and even the greatest in talking pictures as well. But Laurel and Hardy are not so famous now, and probably most people know nothing about them at all. Stan Laurel was an English comic actor who came to this country in 1910 and then permanently in 1913 with a comedy troupe that included the less known Charlie Chaplin. Oliver Hardy came to movies from Georgia. In 1926, Hal Roach, who ran one of the major American comedy studios, put the two together. Skinny, timid, always confused Laurel, and heavy-set, brash, overconfident Hardy. If you throw a Laurel and Hardy picture out of focus, it looks like a dance between a stick and a ball. And dance is what they did in their own way. Not a ballroom dance or a ballet, but an always surprisingly graceful dance between two thoroughly inept characters, overgrown children, really. In their films, mostly shorts and later some features, Laurel and Hardy were terrible carpenters, terrible piano movers, terrible sailors on leave, terrible family men, terrible Christmas tree salesmen. They combined epic incompetence with the ability to regress within seconds to terrible five-year-olds, capable of willfully destroying anything and everything around them. Some people find Laurel and Hardy too chaotic and too violent, although in silent comedies no one gets hurt. But what Laurel and Hardy understood in their bones was that the trappings of civilization are vulnerable and fragile. All it takes to bring down the human-made world is some infantile malice, and sometimes wanton destruction can be a hilarious relief. The movie Stan and Ollie takes place long after Laurel and Hardy's celebrities passed. They're doing live stage performances on a tour in the towns of England in 1953. The audiences are small and made up mostly of older people who remember the boys from their films in the late 1920s and 30s. Supposedly a movie's in the works, but it's not going to happen. Yet the comic talent is still there. The short bits in the film are incredibly alive with Laurel and Hardy's feel for ridiculous moments and situations. Hardy lies in a hospital with his broken leg in an enormous cast. The two of them lose each other on the platform of a tiny railroad station. Their timing is still perfect. Even in dingy surroundings, what passes on screen in Stan and Ollie, all by itself, without explanation, is funny comedy. Steve Coogan as Stan and John C. Reilly as Ollie are deliriously wonderful and go way beyond simple imitation. They get how Laurel and Hardy carried their bodies, down to their different walks and hand gestures. They also get how the two spoke. Steve Coogan grew up in a part of England not far from where Laurel was born, and he nails the accent. Reilly hits the final nouns and sentences just as Hardy did. Most of all, Coogan and Reilly get the feel of Laurel and Hardy in their absurd comic dance. Stan and Ollie left me with great sadness. Stories about aging clowns are not new, but Stan and Ollie looks at the failure of a relationship. In 1932, Laurel and Hardy made their first mistake, a delirious short in which the two have been kicked out by their wives, so they move in together, adopt a baby, and have a stereotypical married couple argument about parental responsibilities. On screen, they were a couple in all sorts of ways. In Stan and Ollie, they fight about their off-screen relationship. Stan pleads that he loved Laurel and Hardy, and Ollie says, "Yes, but you never loved me." And then you see that Stan and Ollie goes beyond the Hollywood biopic and opens up the question of who were these two men, and in a riveting sense, how did they act out their lives together? For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from KUNC members. If you enjoy listening, please consider supporting us by making a contribution at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Brian Larson.
And me, Erin O'Toole. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, as did editor Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, Forest Robots with A Path Among the Woods.
Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
And if you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.